You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, Doug Wilson, who's an adjunct professor at Portland State University and author of the new book in the American Experience and Archaeological Perspective series entitled Historical Archaeology of the Pacific Northwest. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chelsea. Great to be here.
Yeah, so glad to have you on again. So I wanted to start out with how you ended up writing this book. So you've worked for the National Park Service for many years, you're faculty at the Portland State, and have taught fabulous public archaeology field schools, which we've had on the show before. And of course, you and I have been participating in conference sessions and outreach events together for more than a decade. So I know you have the chops to tackle this topic, but does this book represent the first comprehensive overview of this body of scholarship to date?
Yes, it does. And it's interesting how it came about. You know, oftentimes when I'm working on a really intense project or a really big project, there'll be something on the outside that kind of interferes and comes in and mingles with this, you know, intensive focus on a project. And for this one, it was the pandemic, which, of course, was this horrible, stressful, anxiety-ridden time. And right in the middle of that, my beloved mother-in-law, Mickey, passed away. And so it was this really, you know, bummer time. And out of that, the series editors came to me, Michael Nassani and Krista Rozicki, and said, we've got this project for you. And it was this fabulous gift to be able to focus on the historical archaeology of the Pacific Northwest and take away some of that underlying stuff that was going on in the background. And really, you know, in a sense, it was healing. But of course, I had to drop absolutely everything. I didn't do it as part of my regular job. I did it in the evenings and the mornings and on the weekends. And so, but it was an amazing, amazing opportunity and an amazing process.
And I'm so glad that we have this amazing resource now. But I wanted to just define for our listeners what we mean when we say historical archaeology. So it's kind of an antiquated term that encapsulates different time frames depending on where you are. So I wanted you to start off with telling us what it does and doesn't mean to you and when you were thinking about this, the time frame of this book.
Right. That's a great question. So historical archaeology is, in fact, kind of this antiquated term. It goes back to, you know, last century and really is associated with the study of material things, which is what archaeologists do, and people, obviously, but also with being able to look at historical and documentary records, as well as oral traditions. And so in the past, it was identified as the time basically when Europeans came to North America. And in its early days, it was really focused on kind of the United States and Canada. And through time, it's built into other colonial places. And now it's more interested in not just the colonists that came to a place like the Pacific Northwest within the last, say, 200, 250 years, but is really focused in, as well on, you know, the indigenous people in history and really extending their history into the current day.
Yeah, and I think that that's why you were such a great person to kind of do this, because I think a lot of times, you know, for folks, sometimes historical archaeology is shorthand for like history of white people, and that's not true. You've done so much work at Fort Vancouver and other places really making sure that that indigenous and multicultural history is really told, you know, as part of the settler colonial history too.
Yeah, it's definitely my experience working with tribes today and kind of the evolution of who I am as a researcher really, I think, impacted on how this book came out and the notion that, you know, indigenous history didn't end when white people showed up, but is continuing, and that the communities and nations are very vibrant and important today is really important to understand, as well as, you know, many of the other people that came to the Pacific Northwest. I mean, in a sense, the history of the Pacific Northwest is a history of diversity. diversity of, you know, resources, of natural and cultural resources, but also of people and all the many people that have come to this area to call this place home. And so, and obviously the indigenous aspects of that are incredibly important for, you know, how we understand this place today.
And that's a great segue to what I wanted to talk about next, and thinking about historical archaeology as this field. And it's come a long way in Oregon over the course of my career. And one of the things that it's one of my pet peeves is that still most people call it historic archaeology. And a couple years ago, I made the State Historic Preservation Office update their terms, and I told them I was going to fine them a dollar every time they got the term wrong. But it might seem finicky, but it really matters, because it's one of the central tenets of our discipline, and that's that we're not just interested in historic sites, which often are limited to the rich and famous or infamous even, but our focus is on historical sites, and that really broadens our mission to tell the stories of everyone, the unnamed, the famous, the not famous, the poor, or the rich, the fourth generation, you know, pioneer in one area, or somebody just passing through. So can you speak a little bit to how that is reflected in the sites and themes you chose? Like, how did you try to tell the history of all the people that have been Oregonians at one point over time?
Yeah, it's interesting, because in the early days of historical archaeology in the Pacific Northwest, it was all about kind of the white, you know, big men leaders, you know, the John McLaughlins or the Jason Lees, and many of the, you know, earliest sites were places that they had worked and lived and led. But certainly, you know, archaeology in general is really well placed to look at the people's belongings and possessions that they've left behind. And those tell us a story that's much more rich and nuanced than just the focus on the few, you know, white individuals who came here and did something, as well as, you know, the mythology that's built up around those people. And so, by looking at these, you know, past belongings, we can make connections to, you know, groups of people that maybe didn't leave a written record, or they may have left an oral tradition, or they may have left the area and their oral traditions are, you know, far away and dimly known. And so by looking at the material things that are left behind, archaeologists can really begin to understand how people lived, what their practices were, and how they built communities. And I think that's the real beauty of historical archaeology.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today I'm speaking with Doug Wilson about his new book on historical archaeology in the Pacific Northwest. So, yeah, that gets to, another thing I was thinking about is, like, lots of people have written about the history of the Pacific Northwest, but you really frame yours around material culture, and that kind of gives you your edge, so to speak. And like you were saying, it's like, how do these belongings tell us about the people in the past? And just last week, I was in part of a discussion group with some of our students, and we were talking about how history is framed in museums and how that really can impact the way communities understand history and see themselves over time. And I threw out the idea, okay, now instead of thinking about photos and documents, how do you explore these ideas using buttons? And people were like, what? But, you know, the more we start talking about it, it's, you know, it is clear, because buttons can reflect clothing and industry and economies, and they can be documents of the past. So do you ever get pushback, or how do you deal with, navigate, like, suspicion that we are sometimes faced with when we build these histories using broken bottles instead of census records? Like, how do you legitimize trying to tell these big stories using these little fragments of everyday lives?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the good things about our profession is its ability to tack between oral traditions, oral histories, the documentary record, and things. And so we can, you know, learn about people the way a historian would traditionally learn about people, but also we can compare that with the things that they leave behind. And so, you know, when we, for example, find buttons at a Chinese laundry, it can mean, you know, they were fixing clothing, but it also can mean they were using those tokens to play games, which we have from the documentary record. And so understanding the different, you know, ways in which, you know, buttons can reflect, you know, people's adornments, what they choose to wear, which, you know, think of military buttons. That's like this huge thing about status and place and role in the military. But also they can become part of a resistance to, say, the white culture that's trying to suppress gambling, say.
And I think, too, like sometimes we navigate this liminal space between all these different types of resources. But when people ask me, like, what's the difference between like a historical archaeologist and a historian, sometimes I feel like we're more touchy-feely. Like historians, not all, but some of them tend to really be grounded in names, dates, facts, those kind of things to tell this narrative. And we're just more like, what does it mean? You know, this identity or, you know, some of these other things that I think we're comfortable exploring, even if nobody wrote it down. Like, I think that's one of the things that the freedom that we're given as historical archaeologists. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the way that we perceive the world is very different, and it leads to different questions, and it leads to different understandings of the past. And I think it's really important to have that understanding, that what we call materiality, that understanding of the material world is really important in our lives. And I think historians have begun to kind of see that whole aspect, but it's still a very different way of approaching things, and, you know, social science versus humanities. And so it's good for us to learn about each other's work, for sure, because it leads to very, very different perspectives. And I think maybe a truer and fuller perspective on the history.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like collaboration and the importance of interdisciplinary, you know, conversations and reading the literature from historians versus archaeologists can be really rewarding, I think. This is kind of a broad question, but when we think about the historical period in the Pacific Northwest, it's really distinct from other regions in a lot of ways. You have the Southwest, the Northeast, the Southeast, and all these areas would have had different indigenous peoples, different environments, different foreign interests. And so the settler colonial process played out in different ways. So what do you think is the defining characteristic or narrative, I guess, of our region when compared to other parts of the U.S.? And so I guess I'm asking what the so what of the book is, like why you felt it was important to frame this part of the U.S. to tell this story.
Well, it's an interesting question. It's first of all, it's immense. It's an amazingly large space. And me including British Columbia, as well as, you know, Oregon and Washington and Idaho, is you know, a very, very large space, but it's you know, technically, if you go from the southern border of Oregon all the way to the top of British Columbia, that coastline is larger than from Florida to Maine, right? So first characteristic is it's giant. The other characteristic is it is incredibly diverse, that it represents, you know, these coastal environments and rainforests and, you know, coastal mountains and interior valleys that are incredibly fertile. And then, you know, eventually to the Rocky Mountains. And so there's these incredible variations in environmental zones, but the rivers connect the places together. And so, you know, whereby some researchers, you know, look at just the coast, and some, you know, look at the interior, a lot of times these areas are connected culturally through people moving products from the interior to the coast and from the coast to the interior. And it's really the rivers that cross-cut these environmental zones that make it this cohesive place that's important to study as a whole. And that was kind of the impetus for me to do that. That the other aspect of that is obviously the natural environment. We're in the Pacific Northwest. Population densities compared to elsewhere, particularly in the East, are much lower. And the natural environment is omnipresent. It's everywhere. You know, you see, you know, volcanoes on the horizon. You see, you know, beautiful, large, massive forests. And people today are really connected to that environment. And I would argue in the past, they've also been closely connected to that environment. They've had tremendous impacts on that environment, but they've also, the reason that they've been here is tied somehow to the environmental reality.
So I want to follow up on what you were saying about the importance of rivers and the ways that they connected communities and areas. I remember several years ago, I was doing a project way up the Siuslaw River, and we came across this area where there was just huge amounts of brick. And I remember we figured out that it was from a ship that came in, and it was ballast that was from the San Francisco earthquake. And it was just kind of mind-blowing to think about in the early 20th century that these ships were coming all the way up here from San Francisco. And you just realized how much the rivers and these waterways really did connect what seems really remote even today with the faraway markets and even international markets. And that really, I guess, where rivers were and where these navigable bodies of water were really did imprint on the way the state and the region has developed over time. Because if you were near somewhere where a ship could get, that's more likely where the cities are located, right?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, the rivers are incredibly important in terms of allowing a transportation route crossing through the regions. And so you get, you know, like the Fraser River up in British Columbia, or the Peace River up above, which is where the first fur traders came into the Pacific Northwest, or obviously the Columbia River that, you know, crosses multiple mountain ranges. And that afforded this transportation corridor that, you know, not only, you know, for time immemorial, Indigenous people were using to cross back and forth, but also became part of the whole, you know, settlement and exploration. So some of the earliest fur trade forts are right on major rivers and on the coast. So, you know, Fort Astoria, one of the first fur trade forts in Oregon, was settled right at the mouth of the Columbia River in Astoria, Oregon. And that was because of the importance of the river, the ability to bring in ships and supplies, and also to be able to move people into the interior to work with the tribes and to trap animals.
It's so interesting. And I think, too, about how as transportation changes over time, some of those places fall out of favor, like Scottsburg, which was the farthest east you could get up the Umpqua, was a really important, you know, hub for a while. And now it's been surpassed by I-5 and other, you know, people don't think about that as an important regional center anymore.
Yeah. That, you know, once you get better roads, and in particular railroads,
yeah,
then, you know, railroads are the new rivers, right? They're the things that are moving people and products back and forth. And so those early roads that are established, oftentimes by the U.S. military, or in the case of British Columbia, by the Royal Marines, are incredibly important for, you know, moving people to new areas to do things. For, you know, example, getting up into mining areas, Fraser River, but then also the roads that allowed you to move people into the interior to do mining were incredibly important.
And then you also get, when you get the railroad, especially capitalism and corporate interest, because it's not just where the railroad happens to go. People can put it somewhere on purpose to bypass a town or go near a town. You know, that's kind of haunted Southern Oregon because the railroad ultimately ended up bypassing us and going over to Klamath Falls. So it's interesting how that all plays out over time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And some of the, you know, early communities associated with the railroads are really interesting in how they grew. And, you know, certain places like Boise, which started out as just kind of a subsidiary post that was feeding, you know, some of the mining communities up in the hills, suddenly became, you know, bigger and bigger and survived and tied into the railroads and became the biggest city in Idaho. So, and you know, likewise, the Dalles, the Dalles in Oregon became this central transportation hub, which was, you know, not only supplying miners out in eastern Oregon and Idaho and Washington, but also were tied to, you know, new peoples coming in and new products and services and those sorts of things. And so I think it's really interesting, you know, looking at the Chinatown and the Dalles, which was not a giant Chinatown, mm-hmm. but it was just this really important community associated with, you know, kind of this intermediary area that's supplying, you know, the mining. And one of the things that just astounds me is that there were so many Chinese Americans in Oregon, particularly in Eastern Oregon, but also in Southern Oregon at the time of the gold rushes, and in some cases became the dominant part of the community. And, you know, you go out there now and there's not many Chinese, and you have to, you wonder to yourself, well, why is that? And so through looking at, you know, documentary records, but also looking at the material items, you can get a better feel for the Chinese American or the Japanese American or the Basque, you know, ways in which they came into the country and survived, their practices, and then how they wound up where they are now, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good point, that if you were just to look at the documentary record alone, you would not, you know, see the evidence of all these folks living in these places. And archaeology really does force us to take a deeper look, read between the lines, and really interrogate, you know, census records, newspaper accounts, all those different things to see, you know, how their biases might be covering up other stories of people that were here over time. That's very, you know, one of the things that I love most about the work that we get to do as historical archaeologists. So we were just at a conference in New Orleans together, and you had a section in your talk that you gave, which was listing some of the things that you hoped would be considered or done or prioritized as part of the upcoming sesquicentennial celebrations. Did I say that right? 250th anniversary of the U.S. that's coming up in 2026. So can you share a little bit about what you were talking about then and what you think should be priorities for us in Oregon? Because I think a lot of people, when that anniversary comes up, they're not thinking about Oregon and the Pacific Northwest as really having much to say on the subject.
Yeah, that, you know, the sesquicentennial is coming up. It's a really important, I think, you know, landmark of, you know, the United States and, you know, what it means to be an American. 200 years ago, though, this year, Fort Vancouver was established, and Fort Vancouver was a, you know, a major fur trade post. It's one of the first sites to be archaeologically studied by historical archaeologists, and it's connected to a lot of the things that are really associated with how people 100 years ago commemorated the centennial or the bicentennial, 150th of the United States. And so, you know, if you look at how people celebrated 100 years ago in Vancouver, there were all the local historical societies, there were all of the local community members, and they, you know, they did a pageant and they did a parade and they had a monument. But the thing that was different about that is that it was a time where the people that were there that had the voices were people that were not there at the fur trade period, when the actual fur trade fort was there. Many of the British colonists had left. Many of the indigenous people and even Native Hawaiians that were, you know, working in the community wound up on, you know, in Native American reservations, or in some cases people, you know, were absorbed into the community. But those voices were really kind of absent. And so they had this pageant, and, you know, there was this deal with you know, fairies were really in. And so the first act of this pageant was a bunch of girls dressed up as fairies dancing around, which is a really, you know, English sort of thing. You know, it has nothing to do with the Northwest, really. And then they had, you know, white girls dressed as Indian women, and they had, you know, local, you know, men from the community were dressed as indigenous people. The indigenous people didn't really have a say in that. And so, you know, one of my recommendations for, you know, the celebrations, you know, this year as well as the following year for the American sesquicentennial, is to really bring in those other voices, that the communities that really form the heart of history, this colonial history of the Pacific Northwest, and to reflect on, you know, not just the point in time of the colonies, but also the before time and where we are today. And so, that's my hope for our work, is that we will be welcoming of many different voices and be able to tell this rich, nuanced story. And I really hope that historical archaeology can form a part of that, because we can tell the story of people whose voices are maybe not reflected in the written records.
Yeah, that's such a great opportunity for this conversation and for things to kind of be on the radar on a larger scale, thinking about, let's all reflect back and see what this place was like and how we got to now from that period of time. So I think that's awesome. So to loop back to your book in the last few minutes that we have, this must have been, like you said in the beginning, it was like a great excuse to really dive in and, do this literature review across, this whole region and across probably 50 years worth of archaeology, I'd assume. So, I know that some of Sula's work in Jacksonville and on the Rogue River Wars made the cut, and a lot of really fabulous work that have been done by colleagues past and present. But can you tell us a highlight or two, or maybe something that you learned that you didn't realize about in the historiography of the historical archaeology of this region until you read or prepped for this book?
Yeah, I thought I knew everything when I started this, and quite quickly realized I didn't. But, obviously the experiences of Chinese Americans in the Jacksonville area, that was a huge thing tied to your work and the work earlier by Julie Shablitsky and others at the University
Chris
of Oregon.
Chris Ruiz, yeah.
Yeah, Chris Ruiz. And that was really important, I think. And yeah, I knew kind of about it, but I didn't know depths of it, and so I was so happy to be able to read some of the writings that you've done most recently on that, and then also I think some of the important aspects of the Rogue Indian War that were I kind of had followed along with those as well, but didn't quite realize the depth of the work that you and some of your colleagues have done, Mark Tedeschoff and others, including, many of the tribal people.
Yeah, Robert Kenta has done a lot of work with that too.
Robert Kenta, and I think there's some folks from Grand Ronde even that came down, and that work is like really important, and it provided all these really marvelous nuggets to really be able to tell the story in a new way. And hopefully it came across as something new in the book. So those two elements are really some fabulous work. And I'll also mention, work on that's been going on for, decades now in Klamath Falls, looking at a, Klamath tribal, community from the historic period. And Chris Ruiz and Tom Connolly and Doug Duer involved in that, and as well as the Klamath tribal people as well. And that was really interesting to see some of the aspects that, we would look at, if we were thinking this was like a logging site versus knowing that it's a Klamath tribal site, and to be able to build in that understanding of, what the environment means to Klamath people today, as well as what it was in the past. So I think those are really great.
Yeah. And what I'm hearing here is this was a good excuse for you to like look south and think about what we've been up to down here in Southern Oregon. So
yeah, I've done a lot of work in the South, but it was many years ago, and so yeah, hopefully we'll just continue that.
yeah, no, that's great. Thank you so much, Doug, for being on the show. That wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. Be sure to pick up your copy of Doug's book and keep your eye out for events and resources coming out as we approach the 250th anniversary of the U.S. and the 200th anniversary of Fort Vancouver. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.